From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll look at how the GOP's proposed health care reform replacement might compare to what existed before Obamacare.
Later, the Master Singers of Milwaukee feature the musical traditions of Slovenia and its neighbors in their latest program.
Slovenia is not a very big, large country. It's only 2 million people, I believe, Anka?
Yes,
yep.
That's true.
So then he said, I'm going to pick something from the neighboring countries that influenced the development of choral music in Slovenia.
Bubbler Talk wades into the future of the Milwaukee Harbor area.
And we'll get a preview of Milwaukee Opera Theater's madcap production of The Mikado that opens tonight.
It's a true ensemble production, and I think it took us a while to really realize exactly what we were getting ourselves into the first time, in that every cast member is responsible for knowing the entire show.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Earlier this week, we spoke with Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin about her personal reasons for supporting some key aspects of the Affordable Care Act. President Donald Trump campaigned on repealing and replacing the ACA and has voiced strong support for the American Health Care Plan, which would weaken the ACA. Although the new bill continues to make its way through the House, it remains intensely controversial among both Democrats and Republicans.
Barbara Zabawa is following the developments closely. She's founder and leads the Wisconsin-based Center for Health and Wellness Law and a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. She's also an occasional Lake Effect contributor. Welcome back to the show.
So glad to be here, Mitch.
We're glad you're here and hope you can help us make sense of the latest in the debate over health care reform legislation. This is the bill that's now been labeled Trump Care, for lack of a better term. It passed through a House committee this week. It's on its way to the House floor. It might be changed a little bit. Let me just get your assessment of what you see that bill doing in the continuum of care, if you will.
Right. Well, it was two different committees that proposed different changes to the Affordable Care Act. One of the committees, the House Ways and Means Committee, proposed changes that really does away with all the taxes and the subsidies of the Affordable Care Act. The employer mandate goes away. The individual mandate goes away. The other committee, the House Energy and Commerce Committee, passed legislation that would really make some significant changes to Medicaid, making it into a block grant program, putting caps on spending, and then also proposes some other changes to the Affordable Care Act, more substantive changes. It takes out money for the Public Health Prevention Trust Fund. And one of the biggest changes is instead of having an individual mandate, it puts in place a health insurance continuation provision whereby to incentivize people more with a carrot that if to keep insurance or buy insurance, especially for the younger, healthier population, you would get a 30% reduction on your premium if you bought insurance and maintained continuous coverage. Rather than waiting until the last minute when you need it, you might have to pay 30% more of a penalty, and you might have a waiting period for some pre-existing conditions. So that's the mechanism that they've put in place to kind of replace the individual mandate to try to get more younger, healthier people into the risk pool.
So the idea is that they're going to create incentives for them to be a part of it but not require it.
Yes. Right.
The Congressional Budget Office came out with its report on what the impact of the bill as it stands today. And we should say it could still undergo some significant changes. In fact, we hear it might be likely to undergo significant changes before it comes to a full House vote. And who knows when we get to the Senate. The Congressional Budget Office, there two things came out of it. The number of people with insurance would change and the amount of money the government might save would change.
Right. So the number of people who would lose coverage has been estimated about 24 million.
That's over 10 years, correct?
Yes, over 10 years. I think 14 million immediately would lose coverage. And then the Congressional Budget Office states that the legislation would reduce federal deficits by $337 billion over the next 10 years.
So let's talk about that $337 billion over 10 years, because that's a lot of money. Is there something in that savings that would then be directed back into investing in the healthcare system to potentially offset some of the coverage issues?
Well, one of the things that the House American Health Care Act, or Trump Care as you've labeled it, puts in place is a patient and state stability fund, which would provide funding to the states to help offset some of these losses that might occur in coverage, to help boost state insurance markets, individual markets in particular. And so I would assume that a lot of that money would be poured into this patient and state stability fund. Ultimately, what this fund does is give states flexibility to figure out how they can best cover the residents of their state.
And there's kind of there's a philosophical question at the heart of that, right? That you know, whether it should be the federal government, whether it should be the states or the private insurance or private individuals who are best able to decide who ought to be covered.
Right. Well, and clearly the position of the current administration is that these decisions are best left up to the states and not the federal government. I mean, I think that's their position across many issues, not just health care. So it's clearly a federalism bent to this type of approach.
Well, and maybe this is an unfair question, which I am sure you're excited to hear. But as you look at where the country was in terms of covering people and granting access to or enabling access to health care, when you look at where we were before Obamacare or the ACA passed, you know, let's turn back to 2006 or 2007 and where the current bill would put us, would it still be further along than we were 8 or 9 years ago?
You know, that really depends on some of the other provisions that are being tossed around Congress as far as, you know, they're talking about repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act in three different phases. This bill that we've been talking about is phase one. Phase two, I'm not quite sure what will constitute that, but probably less of a budgetary, less budgetary related provisions. And then phase three, another set of or round of proposals to revamp the healthcare system. And within that, there might be some provisions about selling insurance across state lines, maybe establishing high-risk pools in states or helping states establish high-risk pools. And so, you know, depending on what's in those packages, those phase two and phase three, it's hard to tell if we're going to be going back to where we were before the Affordable Care Act or if we will have made some progress. I mean, certainly within the healthcare industry, there is a lot of support for a lot of the initiatives that the Affordable Care Act has really spearheaded, things like value-based care, accountable care organizations, you know, paying for value rather than volume. And those are initiatives that really aren't tied to any federal budgets. So, and they seem to have bipartisan support, but it's hard to tell at this time, you know, what the full picture will look like once it's all been hashed out.
Well, and to follow the debate in the committee rooms and soon on the House and Senate floors, potentially, it's hard to get around the idea that really what's being debated here is how we treat healthcare in this country, right? Privilege, something else?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that really is the heart of, in my mind, that's the heart of the matter. You know, we pay taxes to support public goods, things like national parks, things like public safety, things like infrastructure that we as individuals may never use. We may never visit all the national parks or any national parks, but yet we contribute to that as a country because we've collectively believed that those are things that people have a right to do. Whether they choose to do it or not is another thing, but we all contribute. Healthcare is being, it's being treated differently than that. There seems to be still a debate about whether everyone is entitled to health care, health coverage. And those can be two separate things, but they really are linked together. And so that's why you hear a lot of the discussions, and when I hear a lot of the discussions questioning, well, why should I have to pay for maternity coverage if I never use it? Those same types of questions could be posed in the context of, you know, public safety or national parks. Why should I have to pay for a national park if I've never visited it or I never intend to visit it? But yet we don't ask those questions. But in healthcare, we are asking those questions. And so as long as those questions continue to be asked, and then the debate about whether everyone, regardless of income, regardless of age, gender, is entitled to health care is going to continue to be up for debate.
Well, and so the ACA repeal and replace legislation has gotten a lot of the headlines. You would also point us to another bill that's currently up for debate or has legislation that's been introduced. What is the workplace wellness bill?
Yes, it's a health bill, H.R. 1313. And what it essentially does is eviscerates the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act protections for workplace wellness programs, which means that workplace wellness programs, if this bill would become law, would have the ability to ask very private questions of employees, you know, questions about your family medical history, questions about your genetic information, other questions regarding your health status, and be able to penalize you if you don't answer those questions. And of course, from the perspective of a wellness program or an employer, that change in the law would make these programs much easier to administer. They wouldn't have to worry about a lot of the regulatory burdens that right now are enforced by the EEOC. But at the same time, employee privacy and their family member privacy, frankly, would be implicated if this bill became law.
So this might be a situation where they could ask if a family member had ever died of lung cancer and then as a workplace require their employee to undergo smoking cessation programs, or the requirements could be based on the family medical history.
Yes. I mean, meaning they could penalize you up to 30% of the cost of your health insurance coverage, for example.
And this, we should say, has just been introduced. It is not law yet, but certainly something that that you would make the case people ought to be paying attention to.
Yes, I do believe that people should be aware of it because it might get subsumed into a larger piece of legislation in one of those phase two or phase three proposals that comes out of Congress.
Now, and of course, the ultimate aim of corporate wellness programs is to have healthier employees who need to use their health insurance less. You know, you could hear people argue that, you know, this makes it easier for companies to help their employees be healthy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am not a critic necessarily of workplace wellness and employee wellness and people trying to maximize their lives. But I also see the potential for abuse, and it would be very important that some protections remain in place or get put into rules if this bill would become law to make sure that people aren't feeling like their rights to privacy in the workplace is being infringed on in a burdensome way.
Never a dull moment in the wellness law business.
Never.
Well, I imagine we will see you again before too long. Barbara Zabawa, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Barbara Zabawa is a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee and founder of the Madison-based Center for Health and Wellness Law. She's also a Lake Effect contributor.
After the break, we'll hear from the Master Singers of Milwaukee, whose latest concert highlights the musical traditions of Slovenia. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Since the Master Singers of Milwaukee was founded more than four decades ago, the group has been committed to highlighting vocal artistry through diverse choral arrangements.
The group's latest concert is called Between Two Worlds and will feature music by Slovenian composers and a Slovenian guest conductor, Alenka Potpachan.
Potpachan joined the group's music director, Eduardo Garcia Novelli, in studio with Lake Effect's Bonnie North to talk about how they created this program.
I had some connections with people in Slovenia, and I established a stronger connection with the Ljubljana Academy of Music and with Marko Vatovec, who is the director of choirs at the academy. So the beginning of this is that connection, and then the fact that I went there last year in January. And I served as a week in residence, and I taught a couple of classes, and then had a couple of long rehearsals and two concerts with the Ave Chamber Choir and doing American music. And a couple of also Argentinian pieces, but mostly,
of course.
Yeah, but it was mostly was American music, American choral music. So the idea was to continue that relationship and to have the second part of that connection being this year. With the original plan was to have Marko come down here and conduct Master Singers and Carthage as well in a joint concert. And Marko could not make it. And when I was there, I established a relationship with Alenka, that was a member of the Ave Chamber Choir and the assistant director, and also a graduate student at the academy. And she was doing really, really well. I observed her work. She was conducting a choir, and we had lots of interactions and talks about conducting. And between Marko and myself, we thought that Alenka was going to be great doing this, taking Marco's place.
And so the idea is to bring some Slovenian music to American audiences.
That's correct. Marco's original idea was to have a program mostly of Slovenian music, but Slovenia is not a very big, large country. It's only 2 million people, I believe, Alenka.
Yes,
yep.
That's true.
So then he said, I'm going to pick something from the neighboring countries that influenced the development of choral music in Slovenia. So there's something from Austria, something, just one piece from Hungary, one piece from Croatia, and one from Italy. Everything else is Slovenian, either more academic music or more folk type. And so that's the bulk of the program, is that most 80%, 85% is Slovenian, with one piece of each one of the countries that I mentioned, surrounding countries.
Right. I was going to say they all border Slovenia. So you have different parts of Slovenia that touch all of those countries.
If you drive for an hour and a half from Ljubljana,
yeah.
You are at the border of one of those countries that I mentioned.
So it truly is a crossroads.
Oh, yes.
Culturally and musically.
Yes.
So what kind of music are you bringing to the chorus here and that the audiences will hear, Alenka?
We have pieces from 21st century and 20th century and pieces from 16th century. There are pieces from most famous composers like Močnik, like Čopi and Kumar. Then we have folk songs from Lebić and Tadamić. And there are sacred pieces and also folklore pieces. They're fun, they're nice, they're actually some of them really difficult, but I think that we will have really nice time to get together work.
So what makes them difficult, Eduardo? Is it because of the kinds of harmonies? Is it rhythmically difficult? What makes these pieces challenging?
Psalm 42, for instance, it's probably the most advanced piece that will be in the program, and it is the harmonic language. It is harmonic. It's really advanced, really, really complex. Then Sava Regina by Damian Močnik is something to wrestle with as well, right?
Yes.
That we had to work to put it together. But we're having a lot of fun doing so. So it will be a great presentation.
But as you said to me, the Latin language is most easier to do it
sure.
than Slovenian language.
Where, yeah, even though she provided with wonderful diction tapes where she was pronouncing word by word in rhythm, so we could learn exactly how to do it. It takes time, as you know, Bonnie, to perform in a different language. Other than, I mean, for choral singers, English, you know, Latin, German to a certain extent.
Sometimes
Italian,
French
Italian, maybe. Yeah. But Slovenian is something different, and you have to spend a little time with it. You mentioned that we're doing also music from the 16th century. Slovenia has a hero composer of that time, and that will be
Jakob Galus,
also known as Jakob Handel, has two names, right?
Paternoster is written like in types of composing in that times, so in coro spezzati or in two choirs. So we have one choir, one women choir, and one men choir. So it takes about 8 voices together, and it's really nice.
Let's remember that Slovenia, the entire country, but Ljubljana in particular, is not far away from Venice, right, and Rome. And that coro spezzati that she was mentioning is the style developed in Venice in the time of Giovanni Gabrielli and mm-hmm. so on, and later even with Monteverdi. But this divided choir, the antiphonal choirs,
yes.
So this Paternoster is a wonderful piece, really truly amazing. But Jakob Galus is a true national hero for Slovenians, and well deserved.
Well, and the other thing that I know about Slovenian singing is that there's an incredible folk tradition, too, particularly like all women's choirs and all men's choirs, and they just sing. It just seems to be part of the culture that people get together and they sing in harmony. And they're not just singing the melody, that there's these gorgeous 4- and 5- and 6-part harmonies that people just do.
Yes, Slovenian people loved choral music, and we love singing. So even if we are so small, we have so a lot of choirs. And yeah, as you said, we are singing a lot and in harmonies, and we just love choral music a lot.
Does it start when you're little? Did you learn to sing at home or in church?
Yeah, I start singing in church, and then when I get back home, I say to my mom, "Mama, just sing this line," and I teach her. And then I singing upper line, so the third line, and the second line. So it was really nice, and it's a part of me singing all the time.
And it seems to be a part of the country, is what we were saying.
Yes.
It's like everybody seems to sing.
Let me tell you, by being there, it's amazing. Ljubljana is only 250,000 people. That's the capital of the country. But you have so many choirs in that city that you cannot believe. And then all the towns around it, every town has a choir.
Yes.
Has a community choir. I mean, of course, maybe...
Not just one.
Not just one. Just multiple choirs that people participate. It's something really that's very cultural there. And a little bit of an anecdote. When I was there, one of them, talking with members of the Ava Chamber Choir, one of the members told me that his job was to sing in a men's quartet for burials ceremony. So they would actually go to the burial site and sing a quartet, a men's quartet. Is that a strong tradition in the country?
Yes.
Yeah.
We are, every Slovenian guy will do every job who is connected with music. So this is really...
It's a common thing.
But it will be a common thing for a burial ceremony to hire a men's quartet to sing by the graveside, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
We also have groups for marriage,
for the weddings,
yes. And lots of groups like for many of these options, so...
Any kind of party.
Yeah, right. Any kind of party.
Yeah. You know, I just love the fact that music is so important, that it's just part of everything you do.
And that's why it's great in this program that we have a little bit of everything. We have that historical aspect with Galus, also the academic aspect with Damian Mocnik, a young composer, really very talented, and the folk music, right? Dajte, dajte.
Polka, ukazana. Yes. All of folk songs are really happy in this program, but it's interesting because most of people who are not Slovenian said to us that Slovenian people are so melancholic and we have lots of sad folk songs. This is just because of our feelings. We are a little bit shy in the public. We are a little bit like that, but some of them are really nice and happy songs, folk songs. And they're speaking about wedding, they're speaking about dancing, they're speaking about...
Eating, probably.
Eating also, yes, and drinking wine. Yes.
The important things in life,
yes.
Dancing, singing, eating, and drinking.
Yeah.
There you go. Well, this is going to be such a good concert.
Yep.
And Alenka, you are conducting?
Yes, I'm a conductor.
Wonderful. I can't thank you both enough for coming in today. Best of luck with the concert.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us again. Thank you.
Eduardo Garcia Novelli is the music director for the Master Singers of Milwaukee, and Alenka Potpachan will be the guest conductor of the Between Two Worlds concert, which explores the musical traditions of her home country, Slovenia.
The Between Two Worlds concert will have two performances this weekend, one on Saturday at the North Shore Congregational Church in Fox Point, and then on Sunday at St. John's Lutheran Church in Brookfield. For more information, you can head to WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then Bubbler Talk explores the future of the Milwaukee Harbor District. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers.
Bubbler Talk. Quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
Full disclosure, this bubbler talk was not flowing as I had anticipated. First, I called Scott, who submitted the question.
We're sorry, you have reached a number.
Tried his email? No luck. So here is the question. What used to be located on the land south of Greenfield Avenue, west of the Kinnickinnick River, and east of the old Chicago Northwestern tracks? Then, on the appointed day when experts agreed to meet me, it was freezing cold. So we met inside the School of Freshwater Sciences. The school overlooks the harbor and the parcels in question, now both empty.
Hi, I'm Larry Sullivan from the Port of Milwaukee. I'm the harbor engineer. I started in 66, so it's a little over 50 years.
What did this look like when your career started?
This site here was owned by the Solvay Coke Company. So originally it was a coal storage site or coke storage site. Eventually it was sold to the city.
Sullivan's talking about the eastern chunk, about 14 acres of the piece of pie-shaped parcel.
There was a U.S. Coast Guard life-saving station back in the corner. And for a number of years, that's where they would launch the boats to try and rescue people.
Dave Miske with Milwaukee's Redevelopment Authority says harbor activity along East Greenfield stretches back to the 1800s.
Other uses, there used to be a tank farm on the property. It's very common in harbors around the country. These were large tanks, 50,000 gallon tanks that stored fuel. So they were brought in on ships and then distributed via rail or truck.
The neighboring and much bigger chunk of property, 44 acres, experienced a parade of industrial use from leather tanning to furnace companies. But it's the Solvay Coke and Gas Company people recognize. It's Coke, not Coca-Cola, is an important raw material for steel making. Solvay ceased production in the 1980s, but its graffiti-adorned buildings didn't come down until 2016. But not without careful hazardous waste removal oversight. Solvay is an EPA Superfund site. Port engineer Larry Sullivan looks at the challenge with a glass half full attitude.
It's full seaway draft, 27 feet, and it has a dock wall that the city has put a lot of money in that will take ships right up next to the wall. So it's a unique area where you can handle deep draft vessels.
Right now, the city is accepting proposals for prospective projects for its 14 acres.
We're hoping we can find a mixed use that works for everybody that takes advantage of that unique site.
And the former Solvay parcel is on the auction block. UWM architecture professor Jim Wasley has been dreaming about the parcel's potential for years. His students have formulated visions of the harbor's commercial and ecological restoration.
The big vision that we ended up settling on and have developed through subsequent studios
People want the harbor to be publicly accessible. There should be a public harbor walk. People want the harbor to be densely developed and economically an engine for this neighborhood and successful. And so there's a certain amount of density that's needed, as we see all over the world where harbors are redeveloped.
And Scott, wherever you are, I hope this feeds your curiosity.
Bubbler Talk is a production of WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio and made possible by The Board Game Barrister, satisfying Milwaukee's thirst for fun with games, classic toys, and puzzles for all ages. Locations at Bayshore, Greenfield, South Milwaukee, and now Mayfair. Do you have a question about Milwaukee you want answered? Submit it to us at WUWM.com and maybe we'll quench your thirst for knowledge.
One last break and then just a sample of Milwaukee Opera Theater's unique take on a classic Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers.
Our great Mikado, virtuous man, when he to rule our land began, resolved.
Productions by the Milwaukee Opera Theater are always a little offbeat and a lot of fun, but their staging of the Mikado makes those standards seem a bit modest. The show, a reprise of their 2015 production, opens tonight and features some instruments Gilbert and Sullivan may not have imagined when they composed the operetta.
The staging includes toy pianos and other toy instruments, along with, as they put it, even more cowbell than before. Jelana Ponasik is the artistic director for the Milwaukee Opera Theater. She and some of the cast from the production stopped by the studio to perform some of the songs and chat with Bonnie North.
And all is right as right can be, quite as right can be.
Welcome to some of the cast and musicians of the Mikado. It is such a pleasure to have you all here this morning.
Thank you so much, Bonnie.
Thanks.
And thanks for bringing all the stuff.
Our pleasure. We'll have
photos on our website of all the various accoutrements that that you've brought in order. But this is all part of the show, right? I mean, this is exactly how it's being produced.
This is what, maybe 4%? Yeah. 5% of small
of the toy percussion that you have?
Yeah.
Okay.
Crucial 4%.
Yeah, I mean, I brought it in a bin, and there's a truckload at the theater.
Well, Jelana, this is a reprise, actually. The Mikado, when did you first do it?
We invented this production exactly 2 years ago, March of 2015. And we reunited the original cast, except for one cast member who's switching from baritone to tenor and didn't feel comfortable doing the role of Pishtush again. And so we invited Doug Clemens to join us.
Yay.
And we're thrilled, but there are two performances that Doug can't do. And so we invited Kelly Doherty to step in for Doug. So we're remounting the piece, but we have this wild card that's been tossed into the production, which, though stressful for Doug and Kelly, is immense fun for the rest of the cast because there's this like this sort of simmering fresh energy in all of the songs, and I feel like it's keeping it from going stale.
It's a wild, wild card.
It is a wild, wild card.
So how is it for you? I know the last time I saw you, you were doing La Cage aux Folles,
yeah.
And you've done some other things since then. Does this compare?
It's a lot less makeup.
Yeah.
Less layers of tights in there. But no, it's good. It was kind of intimidating the first day just to see the volume of instruments that we play. And it's cool because as everyone's remembering their track in the show and we're reblocking it, just to see everyone kind of jump in and grab, you know, the whole spirit of the production is just kind of like grab whatever's available and just make some music with it. So everyone's been very welcoming to invite me into this crazy show. And also, what did Jelana say to me the first day? I was like, is it okay if I play this one? She's just like, just play whatever you want really loudly and we'll tell you if it's too much. So I'm like, okay, great. So
that's kind of how I direct in general. It's a true ensemble production, and I think it took us a while to really realize exactly what we were getting ourselves into the first time, in that every cast member is responsible for knowing the entire show. Mm-hmm. It's so different from a traditional production because if they're not in a scene, they're accompanying that scene on percussion, and often they're playing and singing at the same time, which is a different kind of coordination than we're used to doing on stage. So it's quite the cerebral adventure.
And so, Ruben, you're sitting down there in front of the toy piano,
yes.
And I understand you also play a regular-sized piano.
I do.
You go back and forth, but you're also singing.
Yes, I'm actually part of the ensemble, so I have the added coordination also of having to accompany myself on the toy piano.
on the real piano, and then sometimes I play on the inside of the real piano as well and have to sing there too. So it's there's a lot more called on me than in a normal show.
Normal accompaniment is mm-hmm. is easy compared to this.
Correct, yeah. And then when you're playing some of the stuff on the toy piano only, this one only has two octaves. So you're reading the score but constantly rewriting and making the accompaniment smaller while trying to keep it as close to the original as possible. So that's a fun challenge too.
Well, and Joe, you have a special.
Chuck.
Yeah, we do have an additional cast member here. Yeah.
Well, he was in the original.
Yeah. He has perhaps the most stage experience of all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Could I hear from Chuck?
Yeah, this is Chuck the rubber chicken.
And so does Chuck have? Is he sort of throughout the
entire
show?
He sings a solo line and here's a howdy-do. Okay. He's on stage all the time. Mm-hmm. And he undergoes some mistreatment in one of Jason's songs, in Act Two. But we don't want to ruin it for you.
He's
used
really
as both
harmed.
A prop
he
and a stage.
He undergoes treatment, but he survived.
He survived.
Oh,
he
good.
Survived the original production and signed up again for the remount. So we're really glad to have him back.
Traumatized,
though, is he union? Yeah. That's what I want to know.
Well, I'm not allowed to talk about that on the
okay.
air.
Okay. All right. I don't know. Well, hopefully nobody will show up. There'll be no, you
right,
know.
The chicken union is like, trust me when I say that you just want to avoid tangling with them. Yeah.
And so, Heidi, you're the last person that I haven't actually spoken to yet, but mm-hmm. welcome back. The parts that you're singing today are not the ones you're actually singing in the show, is that right?
Somewhat.
Half of it is. Yeah. The soprano line is. So I'm Peep Bo. I'm one of the three little maids, one of the wards of Coco. And I also get to live my high school drumline dreams. I played the viola in high school and never got to be in the marching band, so I get to play on the cymbals and do all kinds of cool percussion in the back. It's great.
Heidi is suspiciously good at suspended cymbal.
Oh, yeah?
Uh-huh.
I'm telling you, it's a dream come true.
The Mikado is, for modern audiences, a little difficult. It's kind of mm-hmm. racist. You know, yep. It's kind of tough. But this seems like it's a way into it that doesn't shy away from that, but also finds the fun.
Yeah, we grappled with that for months and months and months. And we knew that we were interested in doing the Mikado but had no idea what our approach was going to be and knew we had to find something that would feel appropriate for 2017 and authentic to the values of our company. And so over a very long period of time, we just sort of dove in and had a lot of discussions about how we felt about the Japanese elements and the history of yellowface costuming as part of it and what we thought the essence of the piece itself was. And we sort of ended up with this bureaucratic entanglement, which, kind of resonates even today. and that we were going to interpret the score as ourselves. And so we just gradually let kind of the Japanese elements drift away from us instead of trying to embrace them in an inauthentic way. And it sort of got to this other undergirding of the piece and allowed us to be ourselves. And we also dropped the English accents. Mm-hmm. So we're speaking the text and singing the music as written, but as Heidi and Doug and Joe and Jelana and Ruben.
Right, as opposed mm-hmm. to trying to pretend
we're not
you're
pretending
English.
To be yeah. English, yeah. pretending to be Japanese.
Mm-hmm. You know? Right, right. Gilbert and Sullivan is, if you know anything about them, you know that they were satirical. That they were right. poking fun at what was going on in 1880s England. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily translate to us. We don't know those references.
No, and they're quite removed. You know, yeah. We're opening just like 130 years and 2 days after the original opening of the Mikado. And it's actually, like, it's one of the most performed pieces in Western musical history. Like, it's so, at that time, in the 1890s and early 1900s, there were 150, 175 productions going on around the world of the Mikado. So you have to say, like, well, there has to be something of value there still, even if there are some parts that we might find offensive now. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of saying, crack open that score and take a look at it and study it and explore it, and can we find something that feels everlasting or appropriate now?
What do you think they were trying to say when they first wrote it?
Well, I think in a way the same thing they're always saying. Like Jason Powell and I were joking, right? They, like so many artists, like they developed this milieu and they found different ways to keep saying the same things that continued to be important to them, which is the illogical ends of potentially logical rules. That we tie ourselves in knots by trying to follow an idea to the point of absurdity. And so the people in the town of Titipu, of which our production is populated by just ridiculous people who live in Titipu, which happens to look like a room full of percussion instruments, just tie themselves up in ridiculous knots by trying to be other than who they are and by trying to follow rules that just get them further and further stuck in the quagmire. So it's all about a sense of duty to something that may or may not be worth allegiance to.
There's a lot of questioning authority, too, mm-hmm. and people in authority and who deigns that authority upon them and what makes them powerful or not, and poking fun at that a bit.
And so, Ruben, for you, are you sort of the musical director for this?
Yes, very yes. much so. Yeah. Ruben kept us all alive. He prevented despair. He encouraged creativity.
I think of myself more as a project manager on this piece. I'm here to, you know, ensure, you know, musical correctness, and then also to inspire some, you know, creative choices on the percussion instruments. Or we now have a flute in this new production, which is mm-hmm. which is fun. So it's exploring different sounds, interpreting the sometimes really silly words of Gilbert and Sullivan. How can we punctuate that with some equally mm-hmm. silly sounds to sort of underscore that?
We had such a monumental workload 2 years ago. We literally backed a truck up to a rehearsal hall at Carroll University, trapped all of the cast members inside for a couple weeks, and said, figure out how to realize this score using these instruments. And there are a lot of songs. So for each song, we had to start from scratch and say, well, what kind of a color palette do we hear in this? Is it chimey? Is it bass drummy? Is it cymbally? You know, like, how do we start? And we went 20-some pieces over the course of a couple weeks.
So you haven't cut anything out of the...
We cut one song and we trimmed. So we did, I mean, we did condense it to a piece that we could rehearse, you know, and perform. So it's about 2 hours long with intermission.
And so, Doug, for you, now that you're part of this madness, mm-hmm. how does it feel? I mean, this is something different for you.
In a way, it kind of feels like I've sort of lucked out to get out of the, I mean, like the whole trapped in the creative process, what they had to go through. It's nice. I feel like I just sort of took a shortcut to get to where the production is now, which saves, you know, me a lot of brain power, I guess, and just be like, just lean over. Jelena said the first day to just lean on your cast members. So whoever's standing by me, I'm like, what should I grab for this one? And then they say something tinkly. Yes. And I said, okay, great. Tinkly it is. Look at this thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and also I'm not a trained percussionist.
None of us are.
Do what?
None of us are.
Oh, good.
That's one of the ironies.
You fooled me. But, yeah, it's really great just to have always someone around me to lean upon. And it is a larger cast where everyone is so confident and supportive of each other that it's just, it kind of just is a breeze to kind of come into. If I ever have any questions, there's always somebody right next to me that can answer them. And it's great.
Are these the things that you're going to be playing? I know, Jelena, you're not actually in the production, so I'm not counting you in this. But of everybody else, are you playing the things that you will be playing, or at least some of them in the show?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And some.
Uh-huh. So, Doug, what do you have? You have...
Finger cymbals.
Yeah, those are your finger cymbals.
I have two finger cymbals.
Yeah.
Which I play a lot of. At one point, I tried to challenge myself to always choose the smallest, lackluster-looking instrument available to me.
He was making instrument character choices.
I was, because I was like, okay, everybody's already, like, down this road of, you know, character development, so I'm just going to choose the tiniest little instruments. So I play a lot of finger cymbals. Sometimes I take a finger cymbal and a tiny little drumstick, and I just hit it on it. Yeah. But that's what I have right now. And it packs a punch every single time.
It does. He's also Glockman and Triangle.
Triangle. And what's the
egg shaker?
And the stick?
That's a boom whacker.
This is a boom whacker. Yeah, there's a whole, what do you call it? A boom whack symphony in it?
The boom whacker suite? The Miyasama suite?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It does really, when you see these things and when you hold a boom whacker, it really just unleashes your inner, like, first grader when, like, you walk into music class and you're just like, oh, it's those things that are all different colors and we just get to smack them on things. Like, it's literally
we do one piece instrumentally with just the full cast and boom whackers, like a handbell choir. So a boom whacker, if you don't know, is a plastic tube that is tuned to a specific pitch.
Okay, and you're all holding your various.
Yep, we have a little diatonic scale of boom whackers.
Okay. And so, Heidi, what do you have? In addition to the boom whacker, you've got.
So I have, throughout the show, I play the bass drum, I play shakers, I play the suspended cymbal, a couple of different gongs. I'm holding right now a toy chime, and it plays a full scale. So it sounds sort of magical and.
Goes nicely with the finger cymbals.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very tinkly.
Yes.
That's the
we have one
term.
Number that's all toy instruments.
It's yes. all in the piece. All
it's very playful.
And you also have a shaker.
So yes, in fact, Ding would be embarrassed because I don't know what this is called.
Kabasa.
Kabasa, thank you. Yeah.
It's written on the top of it.
Okay. That assumes she can read.
There it is. There it is. Yeah. I've got so many other things I'm thinking about when I play this. I didn't read the label.
Yeah. And so, Ruben, we have the toy piano. It's a beautiful red toy piano and 2 octave. Can you give us just a little bit of a scale or something?
Ruben is a very accomplished toy pianist. And I've even heard you play Piazzolla.
Yes, I've played Piazzolla for a present music event. I've played toy piano in New York and for several of Joanna's productions.
The toy piano being one of the things along with Chuck that kind of goes throughout the Milwaukee Opera Theater.
They're actually both Ruben's pianos, and we use 2 of them.
We have
2 toy pianos and 1 regular piano.
You feel a little ridiculous playing it, but it seemed to have the right timbre for this production.
For
so we thought we would see where we can use it.
And so, Joe, what do you have? What are some of your instruments that you...
Well, I had the maracas earlier, and then I also brought along the cowbell, because we're doing even more cowbell this time.
That's right. We've added cowbell.
Excellent.
Yeah.
You can never have too much cowbell.
Oh, yeah. More cowbell.
Go for it, Joe.
There you go. There you
Here's
go.
Here's the cow. We also have a cow.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And then the triangle. And there's also a horn.
Taxi horn?
Yep. And these are only 1 bin full of the instruments.
Yeah, this 4%. Is basically nothing.
4%.
Yes. Well, and also, I mean, Ding helped us. He has this incredible collection of percussion instruments, which is what started us on this pathway in the first place. I mean, it was him saying, yes, I'll help you, that got us in this mess. And having experienced it 2 years ago, when he packed the truck... This time, like, I submitted the list that we had last time, and we got, like, 2 more bins of things that he had thought of, having seen the production a couple times. So we have new toys in this production.
We're improving on the cacophony.
And then we've had a lot of in rehearsal so far where we're like, well, we have we have what we call the everyday gong, the special occasion gong, and the opera gong. And they're all hung backstage. But we were like, I think the opera gong we had last time was Doinier. So we've had all these discussions among the cast about, like, the exact sound of that particular cymbal or this particular gong and whether or not we need to contact.
So that's a musical term, Doinier.
It was a little Doinier, we felt like. Mm-hmm. And the crash cymbals we had last time were a little crashier.
Yeah.
Yes. You're adjusting.
We're adjusting.
Yeah. So remind me where it's happening.
It's happening at Next Act Theater's performance space.
Okay. That should be great.
It's fantastic.
And I was going to say, and
it's
that's
so
like,
fun.
So theater-like for you.
It is actually a theater.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's a real departure from Milwaukee Opera Theater. I was speaking with my father about it yesterday, and he was recalling seeing the first production and how fun it was for them, because Next Act has a really deep thrust on the playing space. So the instruments are way out right in front of the audience, and you're really immersed in kind of the wackiness of the production. And you see everything. You see all of the people playing everything. We also have 3 guitars. We have a banjolele and a ukulele. What else am I missing?
A ship's bell.
Yeah.
A Revolutionary War drum.
There's a Revolutionary War drum. That's right. Yeah, there's so much. I mean, there's a child's accordion.
So it's one of those things where you have to see it more than once because you know you're going to have missed looking at some of those
instruments. It's physically impossible to see everything. Right. And I know that from trying to watch the video and remount the show. Like, it's actually impossible to take in the entire stage picture at any one time.
Yeah. Do you want to play a scale? Can we play a scale?
Yeah,
absolutely. Play a scale.
On any body part, Joe.
Oh.
And back down.
You can also play a chord.
Jill Anaponisic is the artistic director, and Ruben Pirinen is music director of the Milwaukee Opera Theater. Joe Regenbach, Heidi Boyd, and Doug Clemens are performing in the current production of The Mikado, and they joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North.
There's lots of good fish in the sea. On the subject, we pray you be dumb, dumb, dumb. We think you had better say come, come, come.
The show opens tonight and runs through next Sunday at the Next Act Theater Space in Walker's Point. You'll find pictures and more at WUWM.com. And that wraps up the Friday edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Joy and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski and Bonnie North. Plus, we get production assistance from Mayan Silver and Sarah Matthews, and additional reporting from Susan Bentz and Rachel Morello.
We get web and social media support from Michelle Maternowski and studio engineering from John Strelucky. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.